if you had to describe a car, the physical nature of a car, to someone who had never seen it and never been in one or touched one or anything, how do you think you would describe a car to someone?
That's a tough question. It's got to have four wheels to be a car. It's got to have seats. It's got to have operating controls. It's got to have something that propels it besides your human power, an engine of some kind, electric or otherwise, or gasoline. But other than that, there are so many different interpretations of the idea. There are cars without doors. There are cars without roofs. There are cars that have strange types of wheels or have strange configurations of drivetrains that any definition beyond that would be restrictive, overly restrictive.
I didn't know that at all.
Hi, and welcome back. In this episode, my guest Brad Wyant shares his love for cars with us. We both get to reminisce about how we got introduced to cars, and Brad teaches us a bit about what he knows. Brad has been a lover of cars all his life. He even works as a mechanic for a bit and regularly restores vintage cars as a hobby. Today, we cover things like the history of cars, why human beings love them so much, and we get to nerd out a little bit about cars in pop culture, like the Fast and Furious franchise. There's so much fun tidbits to discover in this episode. Stick around till the end to hear Brad's thoughts on the electric car industry and important things we need to discover on its impact in the wider world. You definitely don't want to miss it.
Today I have with me Bradford Wyant, but I'll call him Brad. I think he goes by Brad. And yes. I met Brad only recently while I was on exchange at the University of Michigan Ross Business School. And I was talking about the podcast a little bit, and I said, hey, you know, are there any super passionate people out there with things that they love to talk about? And Brad shared that he loved like cars and he knows all about cars. So I sat down with him a day to find out, you know, who he was and why he loved this so much, to invite him on the podcast. And he really did know quite a lot. So I'm so excited to have him here. Brad, if you could introduce yourself, you know, tell us a little bit about you, and then we'll get straight into our questions for today.
Thanks, Sam. I'm thrilled to be here. I'm so excited to be part of your project. I think what you're doing is great. My name's Brad. I'm from Illinois originally, but I've been all over in California and Colorado since then. I've loved cars since I was a little kid. Anything that moves with wheels, really. And I think the thing that draws me to cars the most is that they are the purest expression of our need, our want to move, to go faster and further than we can just with our legs, to explore, to see new things, and to experience speed. So that's what keeps me coming back to cars as an expression of our innate human desires. But here I'm just excited to teach other people about car stuff that they could use and find useful, the history of it, whatever people want to know about. So happy for all your questions.
Awesome. I feel like how you described that was like very deep. Like it went beyond just this external machine. It was more like a human desire that draws us to cars. And I thought that was very profound in terms of describing it. So I wonder if other people feel that way. We'll see. But I guess the first question that I wanted to ask you is, you know, we discussed cars versus automobiles. Like, would you class them together in terms of is all automobiles in this scenario, like when we talk about it, is it a car? Is automobiles considered everything that runs on the road? More or less, like, how would you define then what we're going to talk about today?
I think a car defines more specifically a personal transportation vehicle, something that somebody could reasonably be expected to own and maintain themselves, that is primarily for their or their family's use. Whereas an automobile could be a work truck, could be a bus or some other thing that moves people around using an engine and wheels and goes on the roads, or even off the roads, but may not necessarily be privately owned, may not be owned just by one person or individual, may be owned by a public entity and may be used for more commercial purposes than just somebody's personal use. I'm sure there's a more accurate definition of what the automobile industry encompasses, because buses are their own industry and so are trucks and heavy duty trucks, that is. But for the sake of this discussion, let's just say that cars are something that people use and buy and pay for and take care of themselves.
Okay, sounds good. So we're going to talk about cars today. I've also been around cars all my life. My dad has always been into very old cars. And so I grew up, you know, driving around in like an old Mazda 616. I think that was the car he had when I was born. Throughout the time, he cycled through like different vehicles. The first car that I actually bought for myself was a Hyundai Accent. I don't even know which model it was. I bought it for like $5,000 from a guy that was trying to sell it. And then I actually never drove the car. It's a whole thing. It's parked in a yard somewhere still. Also, my dad doesn't like to throw cars away for some reason. So they just sit there until they can't be used anymore. And then we get rid of them. I don't know.
It sounds like me with things in my refrigerator. Oh, I don't want to cook with it, but I'm not really sure I want to eat it either. And I don't want to throw it away. And then, oh, it's going bad. Now I can throw it away.
Exactly. But I guess maybe tell me how you got introduced to cars. You said you loved them from a young age. What do you think drew you to that? Or was it someone in your life that introduced you to it?
So my mom had a Saab 99 Turbo when I was born. It was a great little black two-door sports coupe that she bought. It was the first car she ever bought. And I'll tell more about Saab in a minute because that's such a fun company. But she sold the Saab because having a four-door larger vehicle would be more practical. And my first memory of anything in a car is sitting on her lap pretending to drive that car. And then later on, when I got bigger, she let me actually park it in the garage. And I almost ran it through the driveway or through the back wall of the garage. But it was just an amazing experience to sit there and know that my actions were causing something to move. I think that cars became a part of my life as I kept watching movies and reading books and understanding how ingrained they are in American pop culture and in American life. When I really got into cars was when we met some neighbors in a Wisconsin lake house who had lots of experiences with cars. To the one side, there was a guy who had raced motorcycles and now drag raced muscle cars. And to our left, there was a guy who had worked at General Motors in their dealership program, in their warranty claims program, and had driven every kind of cool car that ever came through a dealership in General Motors' domain from 1963 on. You know, Chevrolet Corvette Stingrays, Pontiac GTO Judges. Incredible, once in a lifetime, every 3 months he got a new car. It was way cool. So I sort of got really great exposure to the most true Americana sports cars ever produced in this country.
That is awesome. That's pretty cool, actually.
The thing that kept me coming back to those cars was the muscle car noise, the engine sound of a V8, and many have waxed poetical more emphatically than I will, but there's just nothing like that sound of an 8-cylinder engine rumbling, roaring. And then there's also the power. You know, you get to be the passenger in one of those cars and somebody floors it. You feel the weight of your body pressed against the seat. It's a very addicting experience.
Yeah. What about, I guess, you know, when you started getting into cars a bit more and you started researching and you know, like trying to figure out like what was your favorite and what are the things you loved so much. Did you ever come across like the history of cars, like how we got to where we are today?
So my research by pure interest of the car world started in the 1960s and how we got there and where that went. And I sort of went backwards and forwards in time simultaneously from that point by just reading more books and hearing more stories and things like that. I later learned that the beginning of the automobile was probably in Germany with Carl Benz and the three-wheeled contraption that he built, which is unrecognizable to us today as a car, but for all intents and purposes was the first motor-powered, non-bicycle-shaped, sitting position vehicle that carried somebody up and down a road. And it ran on alcohol, and it was very difficult to drive. It had a tiller steering wheel, not a, you know, normal steering wheel like we see today. It was a very unique, very strange car, but it was credited with putting the idea in many people across Europe's mind of creating something that did that better and that went further and went faster. And from there, it all exploded.
Awesome. All right. So I guess almost everyone in the world has seen, has ridden in, and or depending on your age, has driven a car at some point. So we are familiar with, I guess, the main components, right? Cars have doors and windows and, you know, a trunk and things like that. And I guess in terms of a chassis, is the chassis just the thing at the bottom of the car, or is it beyond like that piece at the bottom?
So when as a mechanic we talk about chassis, that includes a group of components. The chassis can include the bodywork that holds together the car, which for some cars may be a frame. Other cars may be the exoskeleton that looks more like a car. That depends on whether it's built as a body-on-frame configuration or a unibody configuration where the body is the frame. Body-on-frame is where there's a frame that looks like a ladder laid flat, and then there's a body, a passenger compartment built on top of that, and a unibody is where that's all built into one. So the chassis includes that frame or that unibody. It includes the suspension components, which help the wheels deal with whatever terrain you're covering, whether that be bumpy asphalt, pot holes that we have out here in Michigan, or off-road conditions. And then it'll also include things that don't necessarily make the car go, but help it go, like the axles, which I guess convey the rotational movement from the drivetrain to the wheels, the brakes, other safety equipment such as that.
All right. Thanks for clearing that up, because I always thought the chassis was just the piece at the bottom. But yes, I do know that some cars are like built on, like the entire thing is connected. This is put together. Yeah. So that was very helpful. Thank you. So a little while ago, you mentioned when you were talking about like what powers a car, you did mention electric in there, and you also mentioned diesel. And actually, last semester at my home university, we did a project that it was like, I think, a strategy project. We were trying to sell cars on three different continents. Long story, but one of the core elements of the project was to decide if we want to create diesel cars, electric cars, hybrid cars, or hydrogen cars. So I guess for someone that has been around and involved with cars for so long, and we do know that there is this big push to electric, maybe you could talk to us a little bit about the different ways that cars are powered. If you could touch on those four that I talked about, and maybe tell us about any new developments that you know of that might be coming in terms of powering a car.
I'd be happy to. That's great. So one of the unknown facts or less published facts is that electric cars were one of the many powertrains considered at the beginning of the automobile revolution, about 1900s or so. Battery technology was really weak, but people were still producing electric vehicles. And the reason that they didn't catch on at that time, in addition to the battery technology being weak, was that the energy density of a fuel like gasoline or diesel fuel was so great that the engineering benefits of running that kind of a fuel versus any kind of battery just didn't make sense, no matter how beneficial electric cars were at the time. So a battery vehicle, an electric vehicle, relies on just electric energy to power it. There's no gasoline, no diesel, no hydrogen. And the idea is that the battery stores energy, which has been charged. The battery is charged before you use the vehicle. And then it disperses that energy into electric motors, 1 to 4, and uses that energy to propel the vehicle forward. With a gasoline car, it's got a gasoline engine, multiple cylinders in the gasoline engine. There were turbine cars for a little bit there in the 60s, but those aren't worth talking about. They were way cool. The cylinders move up and down. They rotate a crankshaft. The crankshaft transmits energy to a transmission, which allows the vehicle to shift gears up and down to go faster and slower, much like a pedal bike or a motorcycle. And that all gets to the wheels and makes it go. Diesel, same idea, but the key distinction between diesel and gasoline, besides the operating realities, the smokiness, things of that nature, is that with gasoline engines, you're driving a cylinder up, you're igniting a spark plug, and then that combustion caused by the spark plug is what's driving the piston back down. Whereas in a diesel engine, you're driving a piston up, and the compression of the fuel gases and the fuel and the atomized fuel mixture causes ignition once it reaches a certain pressure. There's a glow plug at the top of the cylinder rather than a spark plug, and that glow plug is just always hot. So mechanically, diesel engines are much simpler because they don't require the spark plug, which has to be timed just to ignite once the cylinder reaches the top of its stroke. With the diesel engine, you're creating so much compression that it's going to ignite, and you don't have to worry about this spark plug thing. So diesel, that works that way. Hydrogen is based on electrolysis, which converts power from the separation of the hydrogen and oxygen molecules. The joining of the hydrogen and oxygen molecules, which the byproduct is water. So it's a less efficient from a volume standpoint still, way of getting a car down road, but it's still very efficient and it's very, very clean. It's just that it's not catching on right now because there are such challenges with the fueling, with the hydrogen generation, and with public perception about hydrogen. Many people will not have heard of this reference by now, but the Hindenburg was a famous airship that was a cross-continent means of travel before airplanes had gotten to that point. And it burned up because hydrogen is extremely flammable, and hydrogen was used to lift the airship into the air.
Okay, that's interesting. And then I guess, well, hybrid cars are somewhere in between gasoline and electric, right? I believe that the gasoline powers a battery in some way, but then as you drive, the battery charges or something. Like, can you explain a little bit how it works?
Absolutely. So Toyota developed some really fascinating technology back in the mid-90s to create the Prius, which has a gasoline engine, a 4-cylinder gasoline engine, very small, efficient power unit. It has a battery that is bigger than a normal car battery. It's more than what would be required just to turn the engine over. It's big enough to propel the vehicle in some cases. It's got regenerative braking, which is the idea that you're going to use the electric motor as a generator to pull power away from the road and from the car moving forward, thus braking it and gaining energy back into that motor. So that's what regenerative braking means. And then you can use each of these different components in different ways in a hybrid. There are series hybrids where you've got a gasoline engine that powers an electric motor or generator, really, that drives a battery that then also drives an electric motor and powers the car. You've got parallel hybrids, which is what the Prius is, where the engine or the electric motor generator can power the road wheels or charge the battery alternatively. And those are the only two kinds of hybrids I think there are. But that's the idea, is that the Prius uses both its engine and the electric motor in different ways at different times based on what the computer thinks is going to be most efficient.
I don't want to hate on Toyota, but as awesome as the Prius was or is, I was never a fan of it. Like, I really just like did not like the car at all. I don't know why. Like, I think I went in a lot of like Ubers and stuff that they were driving Priuses because they were affordable, right? Like on fuel and all that. And for some reason, I just never liked the car. Like, I don't know. I feel so bad to say it because it's good. It's a good car. It's just I didn't like it.
You know, I think a lot of people have had that experience. I think that that comes down to we want to go faster. Everyone wants to go faster. We want to go in more luxury. We want to go in more comfort. And the Prius wasn't built for that. The Prius was built to be as economical, as cheap, as reliable, as efficient as possible. And for the most part, that's what any of us should need. We don't need a luxury vehicle. We don't need a fast vehicle. But those are the things we want when we get in a car. So you have to work between those two things, what we need and what we want. And engineers have a very hard time figuring that out. Speaking as an engineer, I am part of that group.
I could imagine. I did want to be mindful of people who may not have had as much experience with cars, where we talked about a few things. So these things were not strange to me. Like I said, my dad had been into cars a lot. He also fixes them. And so words like powertrain, crankshaft, piston, spark plugs, all of those things are words that I know, vocabulary that I know. There may be a lot of people who, even though they drive cars, they may not use these words a lot because maybe they just take their car to a mechanic when there's a problem and stuff. So usually I keep this for the end of the episode, but for someone who may be listening, they think they like cars and or they might listen to this and they will want to get more involved in cars, is there I guess a place you would send them if they needed to learn about the important parts of a car, the important parts of an engine? Is there anything you would recommend that they read, explore, or look at so that they don't feel so strange when they hear these words?
So my favorite YouTube channel for explaining all car-related content is How Stuff Works. That was what I used to learn when I was a little kid in the third and fourth grade making science projects. But once you understand the basic principles from there about what an engine is and how it works and why it works the way it does, go to Engineering Explained, which is another YouTube channel. And that guy is a former automotive engineer who does that channel. He does a great job explaining current and recent technology advances in motorsport, in safety, in everything, in off-roading. So he comes at it from such a great engineering lens and explains why certain things are done from a design standpoint to make a user experience a certain way, better, faster, more capable, etc.
All right. So thank you for indulging that that question about, like, you know, some technical stuff. But it's a good time for us to get to the, I guess, the less technical aspects of a car, which is not how it works and not why it's important for mobility and all those things. Like, you know, mobility is something we could talk about another time, but I want to talk about this emotional connection that human beings have with cars. You alluded to it a bit when you were introducing yourself and the episode today, and you talked about your mom's car that you loved so much. So maybe you could tell us, in your opinion, besides what you said already about us wanting to move faster and go at this speed or whatever, why do you think cars are something that people feel so attached to?
I think for many of us in the Western world, at least, cars mean freedom. You know, at 16, you get your driver's license. You have the right to go take a car and go anywhere you want for the first time. Whereas before, you were limited to where your parents would take you or where somebody else would take you if you asked them. A car allows you to go anywhere at any time for any purpose and not be questioned and not need to gain somebody else's permission. That's a big step in adulthood. That's a big step into society to be out with your friends and doing what you want with them. It's a huge part of adolescence to adulthood transition. For those of us who have the real affliction of the speed freak thing, wanting to go faster and faster, a car is the most accessible beyond a motorcycle, which is a much harder machine to operate, way of enjoying going fast. And I think there's nothing like that first fast drive, understanding, oh, but if I just let all these rules that everybody told me to follow go, I can go really fast. And there's just something dangerous about that, breaking the rules, breaking the law, whatever you want to call it. There's a rebelliousness to it.
Yeah, we will not speak on camera about our escapades, personal escapades on the road or on a track. Hopefully. Hopefully, you know, in like a safe, confined area, you know, around the track or something. All right. And so then we have, I guess, the extravagant side of it, right? You have things like Formula One, which is, you know, like my first episode was on Formula One and my guest was so passionate and we talked a lot about that. We talked less about the actual like driving side of it and I guess how those drivers feel and what they go through. But I feel like Formula One is like on this extra side. And then you have the people that deck out their cars, you know, better than their houses sometimes, filled with all the luxuries inside of there. And then we have like the pop culture stuff, like Fast and Furious, that is the gift that just keeps on giving. And I remember like, you know, being a teenager watching Fast and Furious and going home and feeling a little bit more adventurous on the road after, you know. So I guess for you, what has been some of, I guess, the most impactful things in the world of cars and automobiles that maybe have like really stood out to you that just kind of validated how you felt about cars in particular?
Oh, God, so hard. There's no one piece of media that really does it. I think that looking back on it all now, the thing that stands out to me is that a car is an expression of yourself. It's an expression of character, especially in media and especially in our daily lives as well. When a character drives a car, it is reflective of them in lots of ways. One of the most classic car chase movies of all time is a movie called Bullet. Steve McQueen plays this cop in San Francisco, a detective who's trying to solve this case. But the movie's not really about the case. It's about Steve McQueen's pursuit of the truth and what he does and how far he's willing to go. He's this cool Steve McQueen. Of course, he's cool. Cool looking guy. And he has this 1967 Ford Mustang in this beautiful dark green. And it's got some dents in the front because it's a San Francisco car. It's street parked. People are going to back into each other's cars. But it's very cool. And it sounds great. And there's a 15-minute long chase scene in the middle of the movie that's very tense and very exciting, where all of a sudden he's just driving around San Francisco, ripping it after this black Dodge Charger full of two guys who are trying to kill him because he's getting too close to the case. And the way he drives the car with the double clutch shifting and the racy things he does supersedes anything about the character. It's, at this point, it's just we're watching Steve McQueen drive fast because that's cool. And Steve McQueen's obsession with speed, our obsession with speed, our tension as he tries to get the bad guys, this huge fireball it all ends in is great. But that car was an expression of the character he was trying to portray as much as it was an expression of him, the movie star. Fast and the Furious is a great example. You've got this incredible era of we're moving away from American Muscle. The heyday of American Muscle is way in the past. So Japanese imports are having their moment. You got these wild colors, these incredible graphics, these hugely hopped up four-cylinder engines that make a ton of power. And you've got these two dynamic characters, Paul Walker's character and Vin Diesel's character, that are just so larger than life and so over the top. And then you've got their friendship and the way that they build the orange super together and what that means and how they are these two guys in the speed shop in California doing their thing. They pull up next to some asshole in a Ferrari and they're like, wow, nice car. How much does that cost? And he goes, more than you can afford, pal. And so Vin Diesel turns to Paul Walker and goes, smoke him. Guy's a tool for thinking he's better than us because he's got a more expensive car. And they do. They smoke him. And that's the cool thing about the hot rodding community, which has been in the United States culture since cars were around. The idea that just because you don't have that much money, just because you come from a more humble background, doesn't mean that you're not better. That doesn't mean that you're not faster than the next guy. It's all about your ingenuity. It's all about how hard you want to work and scrounge for the parts and things. And then at the end of the movie, Paul Walker saves Vin Diesel's life and keeps the cops off him. Vin Diesel pulls this 1968 black Charger out of the barn and goes and uses that. And they have this incredible drag race. And there's this cool moment. The cars reflect the characters. The characters invest themselves in the cars. And it's all storytelling in the movies. But our cars in the real world are so important in the stories that we tell. You have a friend that has their old Honda Civic they grew up with, but everyone loved that Civic because it was the car that everyone went to the, you know, movies in together, that they went out to dinner in together. Some kid drove a BMW 3 Series and he was such a jackass because he got this brand new 3 Series on his birthday. What cars mean to us is reflective of what the people who drive them mean to us, and what they say about us is important, I think.
That is it's true. Like when I think during COVID, when I was buying a car, I was living in the US but didn't have a car before, and I was buying a car, and for me the important things were having Apple CarPlay so I wouldn't have to like connect too many things to the car, and also some really good speakers because I love to listen to music on the road. And I think those were the two core things that I wanted to have. And then a rear view camera, which I think is an added bonus in life compared to parking in the past. And I think that's it. Yeah, it was automatic. There was a sunroof, but it wasn't as necessary as Apple CarPlay and the speakers, I think. And it was a Mazda. I have this affiliation for Mazda, I think, because of my dad and his interest in cars. And the fact that I had, like, grown up in his old Mazda, like, I just always feel drawn to that car. Okay, so what, I guess, then, Brad, is your favorite car, if you have one? And if you don't have one, if not one, feel free to tell us about a few that has been your favorite over the years.
I'll only say two because I don't want to go too long. But my favorite car is the 1973 Porsche 911 Carrera RS. And the reason that that's my favorite car is the story behind it. So post-World War II, Porsche is this small company in Germany that is trying to find a way to do what they wanted to do in the first place, which is build racing cars and sell a consumer product to fund the racing, which was also the story of Ferrari. They finally get some traction. They finally start to have some success. They manage to gain huge popularity in the United States. They develop the Speedster, the 356. They go racing it. The Le Mans race, which is a very famous, it was depicted very well in the Ford versus Ferrari movie. They raced there, before the 60s and were very successful. But as the 70s are rolling around, they really want to up their game. They want to go from being the small, lightweight David to a Goliath, and they want to start becoming Goliath. So 1970 rolls around, they come out with probably the greatest race car of all time. I think it was the 917. And it was this 12-cylinder, flat as a pancake, absurdly complex and technically brilliant piece of engineering. And it just mops the floor with everybody. Between 1970 and 1980, Porsche only lost Le Mans once. And 9 out of 10 ain't bad was their advertisement in 1980 about how great they were at racing. But that was their prototype racing. For their streetcar racing, which means that they were racing a car that looked like what you could buy in a showroom, they wanted to do the same thing. They wanted to level up. They wanted to go above and beyond, just beat everybody like a drum. And to do that, the rules of streetcar racing at the time said they had to homologate, or that's a complicated word. Homologate means to sell enough cars that look the way your race car is going to look to justify that you could sell that product to somebody in the showroom. So that's what homologate means. They had to homologate this new race car. And that included the engine, that included the interior, that included the components, and so on. And they were worried in 1973 that they weren't going to sell enough of these homologation specials for them to be able to justify racing that car and winning and beating everybody. So they asked a bunch of their executives to buy one, even though it was twice as expensive as a normal car of the same model. They publicized them like crazy. They were just trying to push these things out the door, give people discounts. They only needed to make 500, and they were worried they were going to not be able to even sell 500. But they ended up selling 1,800 of these cars because people figured out what they were and just lost their minds. They're like, oh my God, I have to have one of these. This is the greatest car ever built. Ah, it was just so popular, so great to drive, so fast. For reference, the regular Porsche 911 in 1973 had something like 140, 145 horsepower. And this car had 210, and it only weighed 2,300 pounds. So it had a power weight ratio similar to a Shelby Cobra or something more exotic. It was a very fast car for its day, and it was beyond what anybody expected from Porsche at the time. So the company didn't even realize how popular this idea was going to be, but it exploded and blew up into this great thing. And now each of those cars are like worth $500,000 just because of that story and because of what they meant at the time and because they were so great to drive and are. They were built really, really well. I have an old 911 that I restored. Those cars will outlast you and I. They're such high quality. And that's why I love it. It's just this idea that they didn't understand what a great hit they had on their hands.
Thank you for sharing that. There is something that I want to ask you for our listeners. So we're talking about Porsche 911. We talked a little bit about when you described your mom's car, I forget the name of it that you said.
The Saab 99 Turbo.
Okay, Saab 99 Turbo. And I know that in general, cars are usually described by a make and a model, but then there's also the manufacturer. Is that how they're broken down?
Not quite. So you've got your manufacturer, which is the same as the make. That'd be... Not General Motors, because they own them all. Chevrolet, Porsche, Ferrari, those are makes or manufacturers. Then you have a model. So for Porsche, it might be 911. For Ferrari, it might be California. For Ford, it might be the Mustang, things of that nature. And then you have what's called a trim level or a specification. So from my example, the Porsche 911 Carrera RS was the exact car, Carrera RS being the designation or trim level. For Ford Mustang, it might be the Mustang GT, or which stands for Grand Touring. That just means the one with the bigger engine. There's the make, which is the manufacturer, the model, which is the shape of the car, and then there's the trim or specific equipment.
Okay. All right. That is helpful. Thank you very much. Clearly, I was not 100% sure either. So I appreciate that. Okay, so Brad, thank you for sharing your favorite car. And it was nice that it is or was your favorite because of the story and not just because of the actual car, right? We know that there are some cars that aren't that great and some that are better and all of that. And we won't go into all of that today. But before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you, if you spoke to someone about this, right? Let's say you met them for coffee, you told them about all of your love for cars and stuff, and they said, I really want to get into this whole car scene, right? I want to be a car brew. What I don't even know if that's a word, but they wanted to go and they wanted to explore maybe if they had a love for cars as well, but they didn't have an opportunity to really like get deep into it. What would you say is like a good starting point for someone who wants to learn more about cars? They want to learn about, you know, maybe like some of the cool trims or some of the different, you know, most famous makers or whatever. Like if they really wanted to start from zero, if you were talking to a kid who's like less than 10 that likes cars, but they know nothing about it, what would you tell them to do? Like how would you get them involved in cars and maybe building that interest as well?
Sure. So I'll give you three options depending on what media somebody's interested in. So for a book, there is a book called Faster. Unfortunately, I forget the author, but it's a great story about pre-World War II Europe, about engineering, about adventurous people, men and women, and about racism as well, and how that had a huge impact on the politics at the time as we were leading up to World War II. But it's a great story about the automobile as well and about what cars meant to people at that time. It was bigger than football or soccer or anything. It was the big thing. It was the big spectator sport. That's a great starting point for reading. And there are so many other great books out there, but that's a really fun one. It's a quick read. For media, for something you could watch, Top Gear was a TV show made in England by the BBC. And the presenters who did that show, Jeremy Clarkson, Richard Hammond, and James May, for the most part, did such a great job telling stories about cars and explaining what they meant and why, that that's just seminal must-watch TV for anybody who loves cars, I think. And then for in-person, just to go out into the world and experience cars, Google any local cars and coffee events, which is just people who enjoy cars going to a coffee shop near them in their nice cars and talking about them. And they're not all nice. Some of them are just people's cars that they want to talk about that have great, interesting stories. You know, nice doesn't mean expensive. It means unique or interesting or well-kept or special. And those people will have great stories to tell you about their car and why it means something to them. And that's a great way to learn about the cars in your area.
Thank you. Thanks for sharing that. And I guess my last question for you, is there anything that we did not touch on today? You are someone that you love cars, you know a lot about them. You could talk about it all day. I know you can, and I know you would love to. And I ask some questions that I try to stay like very basic questions, right? But is there anything that we didn't touch on today that you wanted to share with whoever is listening about cars or about your love for them or something you find very interesting?
Yeah, you know, there is. I'd love to talk a little bit about the automobile and sustainability. I think that the push to electric vehicles is certainly an important step in decarbonization, but I think we're rushing it. I think we're jumping the gun there, and I'll explain why as briefly as I can, but I could write an essay about it. We're not removing CO2 from the air necessarily. We're just shifting where that CO2 gets injected into the air. I think power plants across the United States are mostly coal and natural gas, and those are very polluting ways of making electricity. And we've got to be whole life cycle minded about where the energy we consume comes from. One of the big detractors about electric cars is that right now the battery technology relies heavily on lithium and cobalt. Lithium is mined at great expense and to the great detriment of local populations wherever it's mined outside the United States, because it's a very messy, water-intensive process. If you look at what's going on in South America, there are great papers that explain this. The long story short is that people's drinking water is being used to mine lithium to supply the electric car demand in the Western world. And that same drinking water source is being polluted by that mining. So us having nice, quiet, no emissions electric cars here is causing people to have real environmental repercussions where they live there. And we don't always see that here. It's hard to understand that as somebody walking to a dealership. but there's more research for a buyer to do there, I think. Cobalt, another key ingredient in batteries, is only mined in one place in Africa, and the living conditions and work conditions especially are extremely unsafe in that environment, and those people are effectively modern slaves, and that's a very poor trade-off to have to make to have the cars that we enjoy. So my stance on EVs is that I think we're not there from a supply chain ethics standpoint for them to be as broadly manufactured as a lot of governments want them to be. And until we can solve those human problems in those places, we need to think seriously about what we're mandating, what the effects of those mandates are going to have around the world.
Thank you so much for sharing that. We talked a little bit about sustainability in terms of emissions with Formula One, but it was nice to also look at it from the other side, the manufacturing and the powering and the powering side of cars and automobiles as well. That, I 100% agree with that. Well, Brad, we have come to the end of our time. This was a very insightful conversation. It was nice to think back to some of my fond memories with cars. And it was nice to think about some other elements of it, right? A little bit more technical and also looking at the sustainability stuff at the end there. I want to thank you so much for joining me. And otherwise, I want to thank everyone for listening.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been such a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. I hope you learned something new today, or maybe you just got to nerd out with us a little bit about why you love cars as well. Don't forget to share this episode with someone else who could benefit from hearing about it. You can also engage with us on social media, and you can find all links on our website. See you at the next one.